welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren and this is Internet Talk Radio, where we discuss what we consider to be the most interesting and important areas with authors, researchers, filmmakers and other people. I'm glad you tuned in because we have an important program ahead of us today. We have Joan Vian with us. She is an independent journalist from the non-profit organization the Women's International Media Group. And back in 1994, she attended the United Nations Conference on Population and Development in Cairo, Egypt. And this was her wake-up call as she found there was much more going on at the global level than most people know, understand or are being told about. And Joan has covered over 91 UN and UN-related conferences since Cairo, which include the economic, political, environmental, military, peacekeeping, legal, trade and financial area as well. And they include the G7, that's now the G8 group, the International Organization for Security Commissions, the Rio Plus 5, that's a follow-up to the Earth Summit down in Rio, also the World Economic Forum meetings, the Free Trade Areas of the Americas meetings, Bank for International Settlement meetings, Gorbachev State of the World Forums, various conferences at the United Nations, the International Crime Court, Al Gore's first global conference on reinventing government, World Trade Organization meetings and others. So she is well versed in these areas and she's actually been on location while these groups and organizations are holding their meetings. She's been listening and asking questions. I also want to mention that she's written two books, Prince Charles, the Sustainable Prince and the United Nations Global Straitjacket. And her website is womensgroup.org, and go over there and check out some of the information she has up there for you. We can find more links to her books and so forth. So I'm very glad to have Joan with us today. Hi, Joan. Thank you very much for coming on the program.
Well, I'm very honored. Thank you so much. Hello to the people of Sweden and the Nordic countries, wherever you may reach.
Excellent. Thanks, Joan. You know, I want to talk a little bit about your background, of course, but mainly focusing on what kind of happened, I guess, back in that conference that you attended in Cairo back in 1994. What was it that kind of woke you up to all of this?
I had read a book. I have been a businesswoman for the last 29 years. I'm about ready to get out of the investment business, and I think you can understand with what's happening in the market, that would make anybody want to leave.
Yeah.
But in 1990, I read a business book called Euroquake by Daniel Burstein, and I was very interested in this book specifically because he had 4.5 pages of acknowledgments of everybody he spoke to. He interviewed world leaders. He interviewed people from the whole United Nations infrastructure. He interviewed key economists from all over the world, CEOs, academia, anybody who is supposed to be anyone in the world. And he came up with 100 predictions for the 1990s. And as I was reading his predictions, and I didn't understand a number of them, but I was fascinated with the fact that one of his predictions was that the dollar, the Deutschmark, now the euro, and the yen would be equal to one by the end of the 1990s. And I was fascinated because he was describing a world currency.
Mm.
And I thought, you know, you do not have a world currency unless you have a world governmental structure. But I did not know where to find or what was a world governmental structure in 1994 or 1990. So I started to pray and ask God to show me, is there a world governmental structure? In 1994, I was challenged by a lady friend of mine to go to the conference in Cairo on how to reduce the population of the world, and I wasn't really terribly interested. And she kept challenging me, and I kept telling her I wasn't interested. It was 2 weeks long, and who in the world wanted to go to Cairo anyway? Well, I ended up going for a lot of different reasons. I found out that my congresswoman was a key player in this meeting. And there were other reasons, and I decided that I needed to go for a look-see. What was the United Nations? What were they doing? What was their position in the world? I didn't know anything. Back in 1994, that's 14 years ago, you very rarely heard the United Nations mentioned in the United States press. So really, even though United Nations was set up in 1994, there was very little that Americans really knew or understood about the United Nations or the International Monetary Fund and World Bank or anything else. 1994 was also the year that the World Trade Organization came into being, at least for the United States. It was functioning in Geneva, but the U.S. was not a party to it.
Right.
So I went to Cairo, and I knew immediately it was my first global meeting. It was my meeting as a reporter. Even though I had my own radio show in the Washington, D.C. area, I had never, quote-unquote, been a reporter before. And so I was all ears. And all I can tell you is that I did not like what I was hearing in Cairo. And it didn't take very long for me to understand, about 3 days worth of listening to their dialogue, that what I was seeing in action was a world governmental structure. And that was my wake-up call. I came home from that meeting pretty mad, pretty upset. Where were all the conservatives in America? How come nobody was talking about these things? And I made a commitment that I would cover as many global meetings as I could to find truth. And one of the meetings that I went to was the Social Summit in Copenhagen. And I remember I was able to get on radio in Copenhagen, and I was told it was broadcast to all of the Nordic countries. And I had put together a briefing book when I got back from Cairo to try and figure out how big, how vast, how deep, how far advanced was this global agenda that I had seen in Cairo. And that particular book, when I got back, let me mention this, when I got back from Cairo, I brought back a suitcase full of material. I mean, it was just so amazing, all the material you could get at these meetings, but you would be very hard-pressed to find it anywhere else. And so I came back with the suitcase full of material. As I was going through every piece of paper, I came across one piece of paper that said the United Nations was going to have a follow-up meeting in Copenhagen in 6 months from Cairo. That would be March of 1995.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, what they wanted to do was they wanted to float the idea of a world tax at that meeting. And so that's how I started covering global meetings. My goodness, a world tax. I mean, now you're really talking world government. So anyway, I put together this briefing book to try and wake other people up. That did not work very well. I was so disappointed to find out that many of the conservative groups and even the Christian groups in America weren't interested. And if they did become interested, it was because they could find a way to make money by advertising that they were going to the United Nations to save the United States.
Hmm.
I mean, it's so very sad, all these people who've capitalized on it instead of trying to do what any decent person would do, and that is stop evil. But in any event, so there I was on radio in Copenhagen, and I was able to talk about the real agenda of the United Nations, the global tax, the world governmental agenda, and the things that I saw at that time. We are now, from 1995, we are 14 years later, and I have covered, I'm afraid my website's a little outdated. I have covered 101 global meetings. I even covered the seventh global meeting on reinventing government.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very important. The most recent IMF World Bank, I was there. The G20 that was just held a couple days ago in Washington, D.C., unfortunately, they would only allow White House press to cover it. They already had their press chosen.
Huh.
So not everybody was going to get to go, and I did not get to go. But that does not mean that I do not understand the agenda, because all of my research for the last 14 years has been to really take a look at the players above the nation state level.
Yes.
Who are the players? What are the organizations? What kind of power do they have? What is their objective? And that's really what I have specialized in. What we saw this past weekend is not only the G20 finance ministers and the presidents, but we also saw a number of global organizations besides the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, the OECD. We also saw a structure called the Financial Stability Forum. Now, interestingly enough, the Financial Stability Forum, I happened to interview Robert Rubin in 1999 at the G7 Finance Ministers meeting in Frankfurt.
Mm-hmm.
And I had just come from the Bank for International Settlements. I had just interviewed the first managing director of the Financial Stability Forum. His name is Sven Andreessen. I believe that's Swedish, is it not?
Say it again.
Yeah, Sven
mm-hmm.
Andreessen.
Andreessen, that could be Danish also, but how do you spell the first name?
S-V-E-I-N.
Ah, Sven, okay, yes, that's probably Sven. Swedish. Yes, gotcha.
All right, well, yes. You now know that I'm not a linguist.
It's cool, yeah, okay.
Anyway, and so I had been really, you know, following what was going on with regard to things that were taking shape. And the interview with Robert Rubin, I asked him about the Financial Stability Forum, and he started laughing. And he said, "That's a funny question." And I said to him, "Well, why is it funny?" And he said, "I don't know." Well, the bottom line is he was so shocked that somebody knew about it.
Really?
Okay, that's what it was.
Mm.
I mean, and so I.
But do you know if? Sorry to interrupt you, but do you know if he was a member at that point on the Council of Foreign Relations?
That was 1999. I don't know that specifically, but you know, I think you're aware that most people do not get appointed to any global any position of power anywhere, including the United States,
mm-hmm.
unless they are, you know, card-carrying members of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission, etc.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and the bottom line is, you know, Robert Rubin was an international banker before he became Treasury Secretary.
Right.
He's gone back to being an international banker. And I'm sort of curious as to whether or not he might end up becoming the a contender for the position of Treasury Secretary.
Under Obama, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
You know, now, I also did interview or tried to interview Larry Summers. And in my opinion, Robert Rubin, I think, is much more knowledgeable than Summers, but that's neither here nor there. He's also 70 years old, and I don't know if he'd want to be in that position. But when I asked him about the Financial Stability Forum, he said it will be a forum that will be once a year or something like that. Wrong. It's twice a year of regulators from various countries to get together and compare notes and share experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And he went on to say that he didn't really know a whole lot. And I said, are the G7 finance ministers going to participate? And he said, no, I haven't participated. They'll probably be corporate regulators. And I said, well, what will their function be? Well, he wasn't quite sure. You know, but the point is that I basically beat him to the punch on what was going on with the Financial Stability Forum. The Financial Stability Forum is comprised of, and one of the things that came out of the G20 was that they were going to expand the Financial Stability Forum from just the G7 to the G20. and they were going to allow the G20 countries to participate in the Financial Stability Forum, which would mean that the key people who currently participate at the Financial Stability Forum are the finance ministers, the central bank ministers, and then you also have regulatory agencies like the Comptroller of the Currency, the Security and Exchange Commission,
right?
Some of the regulators, not only in the U.S., but the other G7 countries. So, you know, when they talk about a global regulatory body, which they didn't really specifically name, it does not take a rocket scientist to understand that it's the Financial Stability Forum.
Hmm.
The reason why they were set up, or they said that they were set up, was because in 1999, it was as a result of the Asian currency crisis.
Okay.
So, you know, you create all these problems so you can solve them, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So I want to ask you, Joan, you mentioned Robert Rubin here and Lawrence Summers, but mainly what I've noticed is that the politicians, it seems like at least in most cases, and the advisors, they kind of come and go a little bit. But would you say that there are there a handful, few, that you could, which faces you could see pop up over and over again on some of these meetings?
I would say that, let me just talk about the various meetings. Of course, you have like the G7 finance ministers, the foreign ministers, the heads of state. You have the various United Nations conferences where if it's a UN summit, which is every 5 years, world leaders attend, otherwise the representative to the United Nations.
Yeah.
If it is like the IMF World Bank, it's the treasury secretaries of the countries that attend. And so to answer your question, in my experience, I have covered 8 World Economic Forums.
Yes.
And as such, I would say to you that what I have experienced and what I have seen, at the World Economic Forum, one of the very nice things they did is they would give us this, it would be usually 2-3 inches thick and about as big as your hand, and it would have a picture and a bio of every person who was invited, other than low-level press like me, and which is okay. Nobody needs to know who I am. And so I would go through that book on a yearly basis.
Mm-hmm. To check
and
out.
I would find who was a Bilderberger,
mm-hmm.
who was Council on Foreign Relations Trilateral. Who was with the Prince of Wales International Business Leaders Forum? Who was with a number of other organizations that play a role prominently?
Yes.
And I found after 3-4 years that there is always this core, this inner core group of major movers and shakers that show up at every World Economic or every annual World Economic Forum. And, you know, so there are those. You know, there is that core inner circle of movers and shakers worldwide.
Any names?
That are putting into place and helping to focus and shape a world governmental structure.
Right.
Now, having said that, let me just add something before you ask me another question.
Yes.
What I have seen in the last couple of years, and I hope to, when I retire soon, I hope to finish writing this book, which I started 2 years ago, and I thought it would be finished by now, but it is not, called The Rise of Royalty in World Affairs.
Yes, yes.
And I have seen, it appears that the British royal family is the main power family in the world, and that they are, as you know, closely related to all the royal families of Europe.
Yes.
Or all the royal families of Europe are related to the Queen or the British royal family. And, you know, the Swedish royal family and the Norwegian royal family and the Dutch royal family and the Danish royal family, those four royal families are very, very close. Oh, yeah, I have to remember Spain, five.
Yes.
Okay. Those five royal families are very, very closely affiliated and associated with the Queen. And as such, every single one of those families is very busy and involved in the United Nations or various aspects of the global infrastructure.
Yes. So, I mean, I think overall thing one can say is that on the official level, they're never, you know, allowed to speak out on, you know, political issues or whatever. Some might be more prevalent to do so in some countries, but mainly that's kind of the official line. But although, you know, just a few days ago here, I put up an article on redicecreations.com, our website, about how Prince Charles is seeking to be able to speak out more on some of these political issues. But I'd imagine that takes place behind the scenes anyway, and that there is a whole lot of, you know, back and forth going on in regards to advisory boards and how they influence, you know, the global political level, as it were. Have you found that that's the case, Joan?
Yes, absolutely. As you know, I wrote about Prince Charles, my book, Prince Charles, the Sustainable Prince. You know, I never ever thought in my wildest dreams that I would ever write a book about Prince Charles. And then, in about 1995 or 1996, I happened to run across a speech that he gave commending the Brundtland Commission, Gro Harlem Brundtland, on the, her committee to establish sustainable development, which became the core principle of Agenda 21. From the Rio Earth Summit in 1992.
Mm-hmm.
And from that speech, I started doing research on the prince, and then I was at the IMF World Bank that same year, I think 1995, and I saw a document that the prince had co-published with the World Bank on business in the community, which is all about public-private partnership. And so that is what my book is about. It's about sustainable development. And that's why I call him the Sustainable Prince, and then about public-private partnership. And never in my understanding would I ever be able to see that in the future, 10, 14, 15 years later, that when you look at the entire structure of world government, that sustainable development is a key component for total control of Earth's assets and resources. And that public-private partnership, you'd mentioned I covered Al Gore's first global meeting on reinventing government, and then, let's see, when was the other one? The seventh global meeting on reinventing government was a year ago, July, in Vienna.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to that meeting as a follow-up to see what had they done, where had they gone, what were they doing. And when you look at everything that is happening today, there is a total change in the structure of government. And you're seeing a lot of functions that government used to do being shifted and farmed out to public-private partnerships, which is it's a fascist arrangement. You have business and government coming together in a fascist arrangement.
Hmm.
Now, are you familiar with public-private partnership?
Now, tell us a little bit about it.
All right. It's extremely important. Three words: public-private partnership. Partnership is a business arrangement. As such, the whole purpose of business, a partnership, is the most common form of business. It's not a corporation. It's not a sole proprietor. It's two or more people or two or more entities. And they come together for the purpose of business. Now, public and private. Those are the different components of the partners in public-private partnership.
Mm-hmm.
The public has to do with all levels of government, local, county, state, federal. with nonprofits or like the Nature Conservancy, World Wildlife Federation, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Okay. IUCN. Okay. It also includes foundations like the William Jefferson Clinton Foundation or the Ford Foundation. And then, of course, corporations. So let me give you an example of a public-private partnership.
Mm-hmm.
In my country, let's say the state of New York needs a new sewer system. And so the people of New York say to their government, the state government, no, we do not want our taxes raised. You find some other way for the money. So the next thing you know, you read in the newspaper that they have an innovative way of raising money and putting together the new
sewer system. Right.
And you start reading the article, and it says that the state of New York, and let's say, I don't know what major corporation is there. Well, there's a lot of banks. But let's just say Boeing Corporation.
Right.
Okay? Boeing in New York the state of New York and the William Jefferson Clinton Foundation, along with the Nature Conservancy, are going to come together, and they are going to work on a new sewer system. So what happens is the old sewer system, as an asset which the people paid for with their tax dollars, is transferred from the people of New York into this new entity, this new partnership. And so the new partnership is now going to run the sewer system.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the state of New York, you have the William Jefferson Clinton Foundation, you have whatever environmental group, and they're sitting, and Boeing, and they're sitting around at the corporate table. Now, you tell me who has the power, whoever has the most money. Well, the state of New York is broke, or, you know, they don't have extra money. William Jefferson Clinton Foundation and other foundations are basically there for whatever they can get. But the deep pockets is the Boeing company. So Boeing ends up really owning and controlling the sewer system. So the little old lady who gets her new sewer bill, and it's been increased because, after all, they are not a government, and they are not looking to provide a service. They're looking to make a profit.
Right. So you were saying that this is being run like a business also, so their main agenda
from
one point is being to actually make some money here of this.
That is correct. So all of a sudden, the little old lady gets her sewer bill and she cannot afford it. Where does she call? Well, she's going to call the new entity and they're going to say, lady, we're here to make a profit.
Mm.
And that's tough. Versus what government was providing and what our taxpayer dollars were paying for.
Isn't it funny how they kind of have switched all this? Because these types of services, I wouldn't mind, you know, if the government did have the overarching kind of control of, if you will. But, I mean, the same thing applies here in Sweden. They have privatized. We had a brilliant working phone company, you know, that was owned by the government, basically. But a few years, they sold it all out, and it's become basically junk since then, you know.
So. Yes. Well, you see, this privatization is a joke because they are taking assets that were paid for by the taxpayers.
Yes.
And you see, what this does is, well, I don't know about you in Sweden, but here in the United States, it moves us into feudalism.
Yeah.
Because people still will pay their taxes. They will not get any services for it. And they will have to pay, they will lose assets because they're being transferred from the books of the government to this new public-private partnership. And so the bottom line is they will end up paying higher fees. They will continue to pay taxes. They will not get any benefits. I mean, hey, that's feudalism.
Yeah. So would you say, Joan, that the overarching idea here, because, again, this ties in, as far as I've been able to figure this out so far, the game plan is to kind of bring in more socialism in that regard on these types of levels, but yet it's going to be kind of a merger system between capitalism and socialism, and it seems to be that China is setting kind of the role model of what we're going to get throughout the world. What's your take on that?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. Early on, I interviewed this person at the 5-year follow-up, the Rio Plus 5 meeting in 1997. Now, for your listeners, let me just say something. I have breadth and depth. And if I go back to 92 or 94 or 97, which seems a long time ago, what that has done is given me the foundation to understand and to be able to work from a bigger, broad view than somebody who doesn't know this information.
Right.
Now, having said that, we end up having, oh yeah, so I did this interview with this guy, and I was absolutely dumbfounded. You see, one of the things that was very difficult for me when I first started covering global meetings was, as an American, I did not know what socialism was.
Okay.
I knew a little bit about communism, you know, rule by force, but I had no idea of socialism, rule by rule. And that was the hardest thing for me to understand as I started covering these global meetings. And this person described sustainable development as a merger between capitalism and communism.
Right.
And so when you take a look at the statement you just made, that's really where we're going. We're going into this hybrid of capitalism. And you see right now in America with the Federal Reserve, with the government nationalizing the banks, and now they're looking at other industries, that all of a sudden people are saying, excuse me, what's happening?
Mm-hmm.
What does this mean?
Right.
And they are horrified.
Because a lot of people have, you know, complained that the Federal Reserve is, for instance, is a privately owned entity.
It is.
But the fact is now then, are you saying that they're trying, I don't know if we should even tie in the Federal Reserve in the argument that you're making here, but does that suggest that they're now trying to make that into a government entity or owned by the state, or is that wrong?
Whoa. Well, you see, what's really happening, and this brings us to the G20, and this brings us to the global credit crisis.
Yes.
And let me just say for your listeners, if they will go to my website, womensgroup.org, WOMENSGROUP, womensgroup.org. We have a number of videos, and maybe you guys know all this and don't need my videos, but one is called 21st Century Feudalism, and that does go into public-private partnership. Then we have the 2008 credit crisis, and over the weekend I did a presentation on from Bretton Woods 1 to Bretton Woods 2.
Hmm.
And it is what we are seeing is that government has become obsolete. The people in Congress over a period of years, now we're talking from 1913, have little by little legislated away or given away their powers to the Federal Reserve.
Hmm.
And the Federal Reserve is a private corporation. As you know, every country has a central bank.
Yes.
You have, in Sweden, my goodness,
the oldest
you have
one.
The original central
yes.
bank of central banks.
I know.
And that's where the idea began. And then it went to Holland. And then it went to the Bank of England. And little by little, around the world. And so the central banks are all owned by the same small group of powerful families, including the British royal family. Now, I'm going to assume, but I don't have proof, that the Swedish royal family also controls your central bank. But I don't have proof. Do you?
No, I don't have any proof for that either. That would be conjecture, but it should fit into the image that we're kind of slowly building here as we begin to study some of these families and what they've been doing, been up to, so to speak, over the years. So I wouldn't be surprised.
Oh, yes. I was very fortunate. Somebody called me up one day and they said, you must buy. It was called Crown and Country, and it was done by Queen Elizabeth's youngest son, Prince Andrew. He had a movie company for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a video on different aspects of British history, and he did one on the Bank of England. And he explains that his great-great-great, however many, grandfather, King William, was one of the largest investors in the Bank of England.
Mm.
And he even shows the document which King William signed, showing that he invested £10,000.
Really?
Hmm. Yes.
Interesting.
And I thought, well, my goodness, it doesn't take a genius to know that if the British royal family, who knows how to make money out of a turnip, if they invested in the Bank of England, then of course they've also invested in all the other central banks, which came after the Bank of England, you know.
Mm.
And so we are really in a major takeover by the central banks of the world. They have played roulette, or they have played the gambling game called craps. I don't know what it's called in Sweden, but you throw dice and you have different numbers on the board, and then this guy takes a sweeping stick, it's called, sort of like, it looks like a, you know, almost like a broom, and he sweeps all the chips off to whoever won. Well, we have the central banks of the world, and they have played their game craps on the global level,
mm-hmm.
and they are in the process of taking that sweeping stick, and they're sweeping to themselves the industry, the banks, the assets of the world and of the various countries to themselves.
Hmm.
And that's exactly what I see in America, and not only America, but worldwide.
Yes.
So the question then becomes, what is the role of government if banking is more powerful?
Yeah, and what would you answer to that?
Well, the answer is that there has been a shift through the central banking system of the power of government from government to the central banks.
Mm-hmm.
And that when we look at world government, although you have the United Nations, and the United Nations is a world governmental organizing agent, and it has been used just like the IMF and the World Bank and the World Health and the World Trade and all the other UN organizations, it has been used to get various cabinet-level positions, whether it's the Treasury Secretary, whether it's the Education Minister, whether it is the Foreign Minister, whether it is the Transportation Minister, whether it is the Health Minister, to meet with all their counterparts from all the other countries of the world, whether it's at the World Health or the World Trade or the IMF or the World Bank or the UN or what have you. And so they've been legislating away their power, and they've been creating an international level of world government through international law. And so at the same time, you have this organizing structure on one hand, you also have the power and the money of the central banks on the other.
Hmm.
And now you're really seeing a major global coup d'etat. This is a major global coup d'etat of epic proportion.
Continue.
And most people do not understand it. They do not see it. They're scratching their head.
Yeah.
But for anybody who understands the international level, this is what it is.
We hear these kinds of wording now where everyone from President Nicolas Sarkozy of France and Gordon Brown of Britain are talking about a new world economic order. After this so-called, you know, what I would consider to be an artificially created economic turmoil that we are in now. But
yes.
Do you consider that what we're seeing rather right now then is, could it be like the final step in this process, or is this just another stepping stone? Where does this take us, so to speak? Well, what do you think the solution is that they're going to bring in now?
Well, you have to get my latest video from Bretton Woods 1 to Bretton Woods 2, because that's exactly what it's all about. The new international, NIEO. See, they had that back in, was it the 60s or 70s? You know, and so this is a new term being reinvented again. The new international economic order. And, yeah, it is. Sarkozy is correct. But you see, you know, he's brand new to the international level. He hasn't been in office that long, nor has Gordon Brown. And so what is really, in essence, happening is all these dummies, I'm looking for the word.
Well, that's a good word.
Puppets.
Yeah.
They're all trying to make their mark, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, who in the heck is Sarkozy to call for a global meeting like the one we had this last weekend? What a joke. What an absolute joke. So let's go back to, you know, the agenda. This has been set up for a very long time. It started at Bretton Woods I. Before Bretton Woods, every country was its own country. They did not participate at the UN. They did not have an IMF World Bank. They were all independent. They all produced for their own country and for their own welfare and benefit. Okay? Then you had the IMF set up in 1944, the United Nations in 1945, the World Trade in 1994, the International Criminal Court in 98. You had some other things set up in between. What is now called a borderless world created basically in the 90s.
Yeah.
I mean, when I look at what Bill Clinton did, my goodness, he should be given the Order of Lenin for all the things he did to change the American structure of government into world government.
Mm-hmm.
And George Bush, too, he did his own fair share. He was no wallflower. And now we are really at the final point. So what is the final point? What is the final barrier between countries? Well, in order to have the final barrier torn down, you have to create a global crisis of the magnitude that we currently have. And so that means all the international banks and the international bankers get to rape, rob, and pillage because it's all part and parcel of the agenda. And they're having a merry old time, and that's exactly what they're doing. And as such, we have a situation whereby the last structure that has to be put in place in order to finalize a world governmental structure is that every country has to change their national financial banking insurance mortgage laws from national laws
mm-hmm.
to international law. And that's exactly what they're going for. That's exactly the whole purpose of the G20. It's not only to give power to the Financial Stability Forum, but it is also to get every country to change from national laws to international or global regulatory laws. And, of course, the country that already has it, countries, I believe Sweden is number one, and Britain and Canada and Australia and a couple other countries. All right?
Hmm.
And so now the rest of the 191 countries, let's assume there's about 182 or 3 that need to come on board.
Mm-hmm.
That's what this is all about.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have covered a great deal of information. You've done a marvelous job, and I'm very pleased with the concentration of data in this first 45 minutes.
Very good, and we'd love to have you back soon then, Joan, and continue, because there's just so much more to cover. But let me know when you have a little bit of time. But before we end, though, I do want to ask you to make sure to mention your website again so people can know where to go to find out more information, and mention some of the titles of those DVDs and your books again.
All right. Okay.
Yes.
Well, in closing, and I'm so sorry that I have to leave after this segment, I would highly recommend that you go to my website, womensgroup.org, womensgroup, womensgroup.org, and we have a number of videos, 21st century feudalism, the 2008 credit crisis, and our brand new one, from Bretton Woods 1 to Bretton Woods 2. If you do not know, I would highly recommend that everything on the right-hand side you print out, put in a binder, and start reading. You will learn a great deal. Now, we do not make money by giving away everything free. So we have the videos, we have the books, we have a newsletter. I'm a little behind because of an illness, but we have a great deal of information that you can purchase from us, and we would be more than happy to hear from you. Should you wish to call us, 301-371-0541. That's 001-301-371-0541. God bless the people of Sweden.
Thank you very much. Again, the website is womensgroup.org. We will have these linked up on Red Ice, of course. Thank you very much, Joan. Hope to talk with you soon again.
Thank you. Bye now.
If you're in Sweden, heads up on the lectures that Ian Crane will be doing in Stockholm, Örebro and Göteborg on Codex Alimentarius and how this will pave the way for international law. We have a link for more information about his three lectures up on our website, redicecreations.com. Okay, so let's wrap things up for this time with Joan Vian. We hope to have her back on the program soon to talk more about the credit crisis, the bank, IMF and UN world government agenda. So for this time, thank you for listening and for paying attention to these important subjects. And if you like what we do here, please tell your friends and help to spread the word about our radio show and our website. And join us in the member section for much more material. My thanks to Fredrik behind the controls. We will be back on Sunday with David Livingstone. And we're going to talk more about the royal bloodlines, history of the bloodlines, and how this connects to the Luciferian agenda and the Illuminati. So take good care of yourself. We'll see you later. Bye-bye.